Return to Northmoor, Episode 1. Running time, 37 minutes.
And welcome to Return to Northmoor podcast. I'm your friendly host, Kim.
And I'm Tim.
And we are going to be doing an introduction to the world that Tim has created and how we went about character creation in this episode.
Yep.
All right. So just a little background on how we're going about this. We're going for our first level through 30th level in 4th edition with hopefully the same characters.
You guys don't all die.
You know, it would be unfortunate if you killed us all off.
Hey, you know, there's no killer DMs. There's just unfortunately dumb players.
Hey, you know, it's not my fault that Wick can't roll worth a damn.
Yeah, the dice have killed you guys almost literally several times already.
It's sad when the warlock is doing more damage than the fighter.
Well, if Wick hadn't bought those $37,000 solid gold dice or whatever he had that crack our table every time he rolls them, he might have a better chance.
I think he might be compensating.
Clearly.
So anyway, we are also doing accelerated EXP, which means that I believe, Tim, you're doubling it for us.
Right. So there's a lot of different ways to do faster experience progression. And in previous editions of the game, I had sort of various formulas worked out to make it go more smoothly. But right in the 4th edition DMG, it says if you're looking for a faster game, then just double the experience you give for everything, and that will move you along. So that's what we're going to go ahead and do for this campaign. What that means is if you want to run at a slower pace, you might need to fill in with extra encounters between things to get your people up to the level.
One of the goals that all of the individuals in our group had is that they wanted to take a character from first level on through 30th level, because most of the time we end up getting stagnated at about 4th or 5th. Now, keep in mind that Jeff's favorite level to play is first level, and my favorite character class to play or character level to play is about 9th or 10th. And so we're going to see how this all shakes out.
And if there's something that we've already learned about 4th edition, it seems like the levels are about divided in half. So 1st and 2nd level are kind of the same, 3rd and, you know, 4th level are kind of the same. We'll have to see how that holds as the levels go on.
Well, and it is a little bit more interesting with 4th edition with level progression because you get something every level.
Although I have to say, after you guys just leveled to 3rd level, and we, you know, you'll get to those shows here soon enough, dear listeners, you really don't seem to get that much. I mean, you get some hit points and one power.
I'm not going to complain. I've played plenty of magic users in the past, and, well, there's my magic missile just doesn't cut it.
Well, I mean, clearly 4th edition gives you more at every level. Well, I mean, the good news is it didn't take you guys very long to level to level 3, did it? I mean, you picked one power and add some hit points and on we go.
Unlike all the even levels.
Yeah, having to adjust every number for the level divided by 2 definitely took some time.
So we'll be giving you some tips and hints about that because we're finding out about 4th edition much like everybody else.
Exactly.
Tim, why don't you talk about how you came up upon this kind of world creation?
Sure. One of the things that we've been experimenting with among our group of friends for a long time is this idea of world creation as something that the whole group gets to participate in. Wick and some of his friends had created this whole game around doing that. They ran at conventions where everybody would come together and each of them would create a different nation and they would draw out the world and they'd do all that stuff. And it was an awesome, awesome game. And it really had no sort of mechanical system to it. It was just sort of a method for shared world creation that you could do in a specific amount of time.
And that tends to keep players involved because they are invested in that world.
Sure. And it really became something where you're not role-playing a character, you're role-playing an entire nation, an entire people.
Exactly.
That had a lot of appeal, and we had a lot of fun with that for many years. And then I kind of came up with this thing that I termed Mad Hacks, and it was something that I ran at cons for quite a few years, where you are sitting down with a group of people at a convention setting where one of them is going to have to DM this game. And the whole idea is to sit down and you give them a sort of Mad Libs style template where a bunch of the stuff's figured out for you ahead of time, especially if you're running a rules heavy system. A lot of the mechanical stuff is figured out for you ahead of time, but a lot of the story stuff is open blanks.
I know that when we first ran Mad Hacks, the first tournament we did that at, it kind of sent a lot of people into a different place because we had 7 people show up and your typical slot is 6. And suddenly there's seven people there. And we said, this is how this game is going to run. And there were a few arguments about who's going to run this game. I didn't want a GM. Hold it. What's going to go on?
Yeah, I mean, even though it clearly said in the instructions that someone was going to have to GM, everybody, I guess, assumed it was going to be someone other than them.
But in the Mad Hacks template, the GM wasn't responsible for coming up with every ounce of idea.
One of the things that Mad Hacks really did is it brought what we now would call an indie game sensibility in terms of all the players contributing and it really being a shared sort of storytelling experience to a traditional style game like D&D, or you ran an excellent Spycraft one, and we actually, I think, had a couple other systems as well. I know I ran a Cthulhu one.
And it really does work out well, and it's particularly interesting to see how several different groups take the same materials and come up with something completely different.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, of course, each GM, if they're really running on the fly, is going to play to their strengths. So a lot of them are going to play stuff that they've run it before and is kind of their old standbys. But because they're playing with a group of people that's not their usual group, those people haven't seen that stuff before. So a lot of them are just jaw-droppingly amazed at what these GMs are pulling out of their hat.
And most of the time, these GMs are pulling this stuff out in a matter of an hour to an hour and a half.
So we really had a lot of fun with that. But as the convention scene here in Denver sort of took a turn to being not exactly what we were looking for, we were looking for that same sort of experience in our home campaign as well.
So then Tim went ahead and decided to start creating worlds in this fashion.
What I'm going to do is kind of explain the method that I used to come up with this world and how I went about leaving holes for the players to fill in.
He'll also talk about what this world is in his mind. I know that Tim has done a great deal of research on kind of the area that he wanted to place this world in and kind of the cultures that are there.
And, you know, people talk about, well, do you come up with the story first or the world first? And it really is, you know, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and they all influence each other. But what I actually typically start with is, what do I want the group of players to be like? What are the characters going to be like? You know, a lot of people have said, well, how can you possibly do that when the players are going to be able to create their own characters? But one of the lessons that we've really learned is that unless you really have a solid idea of who the characters are as a group, what the Fear the Boot guys have called a group template, you really have a hard time putting together a cohesive, long-running campaign.
Exactly. And so giving your players constraints that they have to work within typically leads to a much more cohesive party.
If you look at Joe, who's over on the podcast, he rails against this whole concept of a group template and how it's restrictive and everything else. But Luke has criticized him for being that guy who always wants to do whatever the opposite is of what the rest of the group is doing. And, you know, that's fine. And we certainly have had players like that. But what we found is, in order to kind of maximize our fun, given that we've only got a very short amount of time to play every other week, it really pays to sit down and say, let's come up with a group of people that has a reason to stay together, a reason to trust each other, and really a reason to go out on an adventure.
But one of the pitfalls of that is leaving enough space in there for, in the eventuality that a character dies, and they better not die, that somebody new can come into the group.
Right. And of course, it may not be a character death, but it might be that someone has to drop out for a little while or even permanently or whatever. And you don't want that to completely ruin your story.
And there's also the possibility that you might meet somebody new at a convention or another gaming group that's looking for a little bit extra fun. And you want to bring them on in.
So you want a group template that's stiff enough to kind of corral the players in a way that makes them a cohesive group, but is flexible enough to accommodate changes in players, and is frankly flexible enough to allow characters enough range of personality types. You don't want players to all have to create the exact same character.
So, Tim, why don't you tell us a little bit about the world and what inspired you to get there?
What I did for this particular game, since we were starting over at first level, and after reading through the fourth edition materials, it really had that sort of first edition feel again, I thought. What that said to me, of course, is like Keep on the Borderlands. But of course, reading Keep on the Shadowfell, they pretty much rewrote Keep on the Borderlands.
Pretty much exactly.
Exactly. So, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's just I wanted to have that sort of best of D&D tropes. So the first thing I did is I sat down with all of you guys, with Wick and Jeff and Dan and Kim, and said, well, what's the favorite sort of tropes that you remember from your favorite games throughout time?
You know, a lot of us said, well, we really like that sense of adventure.
Right.
And we also went ahead and said, we like dungeon crawl, but we also like to have that wilderness setting, as well as traps, having to deal with a different culture, perhaps an ancient culture.
Right. And you liked having a home base to come back to.
Absolutely. Everybody likes to have their home base where they can feel somewhat safe, that the people that they know are there.
Right. And from games I've run in the past, I've found that if that home base has NPCs that are sort of worth coming home to, it really adds another dimension to the role playing so that everybody you're role playing with isn't someone that you're sort of in a tense situation with.
That, and you can always make relationships with those NPCs. So it's a lot easier to have somebody to play off of later on. I know that you can also feel comfortable basing your character on those NPCs as well.
One of the key concepts of the world of 4th edition that comes in the player's handbook and DMG is that there's these points of light, that there's small pieces of civilization that are relatively safe, but everything else in between it is dangerous wilds filled with monsters, which I really like, because there came a point toward the end of 2nd edition Forgotten Realms, for example, where you honestly wondered how possibly monsters could survive in the world with 30,000 30th level wizards running around.
Isn't that what the Underdark is for?
Yeah, but even the Underdark, I mean, as many people as went down there and giant high level characters, you know, Mordenkainen should have blown them all away. Sorry, Mordenkainen, I guess, was Greyhawk. I'm thinking of
Elminster?
Kelvin Blackstaff, I guess. Sorry, my Forgotten Realms knowledge is not what it used to be, thank God. I mean, it just seemed like it was the modern world with magic instead of technology.
Well, there was that.
I really liked that first edition dangerous feel that the points of light concept had. So I started with the idea that I want the characters to have this tight integration with each other and that I wanted to have this really dangerous world. And so I started trying to think about how to bring those two concepts together.
And the whole idea of, you know, having a keep on the borderlands, having something in that general vein.
I started with the idea that there was an outpost and a semi-military outpost. I say semi-military because I didn't want it to be so well organized that it was an active, carefully managed military operation that was run directly by a hardcore king or whatever.
And one of the things that we kind of came up against was, well, a military outpost then implies that it's only fighters.
Sure, which, if you're thinking about the modern military, it makes perfect sense, but it's a fantasy world. And so if you truly extend your brain into the military in a fantasy world is going to have to take advantage of every resource that's available to it. You may not have rocket launchers, but you've got magicians.
Why wouldn't you have your artillery folks using fireballs as artillery?
I think that that's something that we kind of had to get over, at least some of the people had to get over, was this concept that if you're at a military outpost, you pretty much had to play a fighter. Once we got people over that, it actually kind of made people think of some new character concepts they may not have thought of.
Yeah.
So what I did is I came up with the idea that there's this outpost and it is on the edge of a bog. We hadn't really had the opportunity in at least our games to spend a lot of time in a sort of swampy setting. What I like about the swamp setting is it gives you this idea of water-based role-playing, which is always kind of interesting and scary, without having it to be completely underwater or at sea or something like that.
And Tim loves undead. And undead love kind of swampy, nasty kind of areas.
Well, and like anything you do in life, as soon as you start thinking about this, you start seeing it everywhere. It wasn't 2 days after I had kind of decided on a bog for this that the Bog Mummies special came on the Science Channel. And
yay for the DVR.
Yeah, that show scared the crap out of our child.
Yeah, that was a few sleepless nights.
Yeah. But that's just pointing out the concept that these well-preserved bodies in the bog is a freaky concept, and thus it's a good thing to explore in a game.
Well, and there's a lot of historical fact that we can base our game on then.
So what I did is I kind of looked at the ecology of bogs, what kind of creatures are in bogs, what kind of economy surrounds bogs. And if you look at your typical sort of, you know, English bog or Irish bog or Scottish bog, there's two big things that come around economically. One is that you're digging the peat out of the bog to burn and to make your houses out of.
Sure.
The second is that bogs tend to have all kinds of interesting minerals and other sort of natural resources in them.
Don't forget the whiskey.
Ah, well, yes. So then, of course, if what you have to burn instead of trees is peat, which to me is kind of just a nasty concept, if you're burning that, then whatever liquor you're distilling, of course, is going to have that peaty flavor.
There's nothing wrong with Talisker.
Yeah, I'm not a whiskey guy. You and Wick can share the whiskey.
And we will.
Yeah, so brewing, mining, and or sort of natural resource extraction, and then peat seemed to be the big sort of economic things. And when I started thinking about mining, we had actually just come off of playing a really cool Western game that I had run right before Wick had run a really cool sort of post-apocalyptic game. And I really liked the whole mining town concept and the lawlessness of that, and really the whole idea that you can get away with everything you want to get away with, but when the bad guys come to town, everybody sort of bands together, even if they normally don't get along.
And Tim gets plenty of inspiration from my parents, who live, again, in this very rural area. While it's not like that now, it wasn't all that long ago that cowboys and Indians really did exist there.
Jeff, who was one of our players, is a huge Western fan, so anything I can do to kind of play to that helps keep his interest as well. So the idea of this mining town, it's rough and ready, it's sort of in the middle of nowhere, it's on the edge of this just nasty, dangerous bog. I started thinking about, well, why is it there? Why is it physically located there? Because people don't just plop cities in random spots. So the first thing is when you're thinking about a medievalish city, and of course we're thinking medieval as in the Renaissance fair sort of medieval, not, you know, historically accurate Black Plague sort of medieval.
Oh, Black Plague.
Being a microbiologist, how do you feel about the Black Plague?
Not my favorite disease, that's for sure.
Well, I tell you, with all the prairie dogs we have around here, I'm sure we're going to get it sooner or later.
Yeah, well, you know, and the squirrels.
Ugh, just disgusting. The reason that you built this city here, I've decided, is because it's right next to a river, which almost all ancient cities were next to rivers because they both served as water source to drink, and for washing and waste disposal and food, and you know, rivers really are the lifeblood of an ancient city.
Well, and typically rivers that have a bog around them are on a delta. Exactly. And those cities are oftentimes ports to whatever sea and or ocean they are next to.
So, of course, I'm thinking bog as in like New Orleans, because, of course, New Orleans was basically a giant swamp before they built it there. And it's almost still a swamp if you've been there, you know what I mean. The concept of New Orleans, I wanted to make that a little different, a little more European. So I actually...
Sad to think that New Orleans could even be more European than
true.
It already
well,
is.
Well, that's true. I mean, New Orleans is the most European city in the United States.
You're talking more Northern European.
Yeah, more like English, Irish, you know, your typical sort of what you think of when you think fantasy, or at least what I think of when I think fantasy. So I wanted to make it colder, first of all, and more like a misty, cold, rainy type bog and not a hot, stinky swamp type situation. That's why I really went bog instead of swamp.
So a little bit different on the horror aspect.
Yeah, exactly. So then you've got this cold, misty bog. And one of the really cool things about all of the British Isles and really all of Europe is you have all these ancient ruins. And a lot of times they don't even know who built these ruins. And they've built on top of them. They've pulled the rocks out of one house to make their own house. You're building, you know, civilization upon civilization upon civilization. And I really like that concept of kind of digging down and discovering some ancient civilization that you have no idea about. And especially in a fantasy setting where that civilization might have had crazy, strange magic or something, I think it gets even cooler.
Well, and the way that 4th edition has this set up, there's a whole lot of different avenues that you can take. The Shadowfell.
Right.
As well as the Far Reaches.
Sure.
Or the Far Realms is what it's called now.
Sure. And then there's also the, there's the Elemental Chaos.
Well, and then there's the whole fae side
right.
of things.
Yeah. With all of those different sort of things coming together in a nexus, I really like the idea of the main adventuring place being this bog and the civilization around it sort of being your home base. So there's two home bases. One is this semi-military outpost, which is on one side of the bog right next to the sea. And it's ostensibly there to protect against pirates and raiders and whatever kind of creepy stuff comes out of the ocean. And then on the other side of the bog, at the end of the river empties out into the bog, which then empties out into the sea, is a port, the last port before the end of the world, if you will.
And so there's somewhat of a town there.
Right, and this is the mining town that we kind of discussed, and I called it the Lost Village. The reason I called it the Lost Village, the terrain around here isn't fixed. The water goes up, the water goes down, and a few years ago when the water went down, it revealed all of these ruins right in this area. And of course, in the ruins were gold.
And other sundry items.
Someone found these things as they were rafting down the river heading toward the outpost, and they decided to build a little village there. And over the last few years, it's grown into a place where all sorts of people seeking to come and dig gold out of the bottom have shown up trying to seek their fortune.
And of course, with that kind of environment, you're going to end up having a little bit of lawlessness.
Absolutely.
As people tend to be greedy and want their gold.
Because the bog is incredibly dangerous. You have them banding together to protect the town and also to have sort of a code of, if you're out in the swamp and a whole bunch of sturges attack, are you going to save your guy or are you going to wait for him to get eaten and then go take his gold? Well, we decided that the overall feeling was, you know, you're going to save him if you can.
Well, and there's always the consideration that you need someplace to reprovision.
Right.
Because once you run out of food, potable water, whatever you need to go digging, that you need someplace to go back to.
And even though this is a fantasy world, we're really going with the, you know, not everybody's teleporting. In fact, teleportation other than the Eladrin face steps sort of thing is incredibly rare. And as a result, it takes a long time to get anywhere. And so you need a lot of little stops along the way to reprovision and to rest.
So do you consider your world to be low, mid, mid or high magic?
I would say that it's a rough and ready setting, and that the magic level is on an individual by individual basis. Overall, in this area, the Northmoor area, it's low-ish magic, although that's going to change.
Well, and keep that in mind when you're putting this together for your own group.
I'm going to go low magic in terms of the NPCs and the world at large. The PCs will probably have more magic than anyone else really soon.
Well, they don't call them heroes for nothing.
Yeah, and 4E makes a very heavy distinction between heroes and the rest of the world.
So we have a military type of outpost. We
right.
have a village on the other side of a bog, which is monster ridden as well as treasure ridden.
We kind of stopped there, or at least I stopped there when defining the world. I figured those three locations would provide plenty of opportunity for both role-playing type adventures in the village and in the outpost, as well as dungeon crawling monster type adventures in the bog. And I really didn't want to detail too much of the world beyond that, because one mistake that a lot of novice people creating worlds make is they want to detail the entire world soup to nuts before they start.
Well, and then when we started character creation, I threw a few wrenches into his plans, because I brought in a new city, I brought in new experiences based on places that I had been, and he kind of had to add those into his world.
So I started with a core world that was really focused on what kind of place can I set a lot of cool adventures? What kind of place can I have a cool set of characters that they can work together? And that's it. I stopped right there and I said, I'm going to sit down with the players and I'm going to tell them this much and see what they have to bring to the story.
So that kind of brings us to character creation and the players' involvement in world creation. Tim was so kind to provide us with a questionnaire of sorts and really what we wanted to add to this world. So we had group items and individual items. And we will be putting those on to the forums so that you can see each of them. As just kind of a highlight, Tim wanted to know what each character had as their role at the outpost, why they were going to be there, and some of their background.
What I did is I came up with a set of constraints for each character. You know, people rail against the concept of constraints. Oh, you're keeping me down and whatever else. But if you ever go do like a writer's exercise, the first thing they say is write a story that has this, this, and this in it and covers this topic. They don't just say write a story, because there's nothing that's more difficult than a completely blank page. Sure, if you've got a burning, churning idea, maybe that's easy, but if you've played as many characters and as many campaigns as we have, sometimes it's very difficult to start with a complete blank slate and you end up, you know, falling back into old patterns.
And having the opportunity to add something to our world made it very nice, because then we're invested in that world and we don't say, you know, Tim, this setting's kind of lame. We don't want to be dealing with a bog. You know, we'd rather be in the Bahamas.
So instead I say, you know what, there's going to be a bog, there's going to be an outpost, there's going to be a village. All of you at one time or other worked at the outpost at the same time, you know, with each other. What you guys have to decide is what you did there, what your relationship was to the mentor, I called him, which I decided there was a mentor at the outpost that you all knew. And again, that was another thing to sort of tie the characters together in a group template sort of way. Why you left the outpost and why you aren't there anymore.
And so that led to a lot of character discussion where the four players all got together. And we had come up with our own ideas based on this questionnaire and had filled out our individual items fairly carefully. My personal take on making a character is I like to have a basic idea. And for this particular campaign, my character is an Eladrin warlock. And I like to come up with a whole background. Characters do not spring fully formed from the page. This person was born, was a child, had a life at one point before adventuring. And I like to detail that because oftentimes my particular vision of what my character will be changes once I've made that background.
And what you really wanted to do was explore sort of the Eladrin-ness of an Eladrin. You had sort of said, you know, this Eladrin looks cool. And then once you did that, you said, well, what kind of character would really that be? Fine, I'm this sort of otherworldly fae, but what sort of characters are those?
So I took that kind of basis and a lot of the literature that I've read and said, well, these Eladrin seem to have their own culture, their own societies. We're going to make this a high society. We're going to make this very royal-based, somewhat caste-based. And I made a new city for Tim to deal with that is right off the shore that hovers above the sea by the outpost. It's in the Feywild.
So it's there, but your average Joe soldier at the outpost doesn't even know it's up.
So Tim then has another place to throw us if we get either kicked out of the bog in some fashion, or if the game seems a little bit flow, so that the characters have this idea of a mystery on the other side.
So what I did is I came up with this tight kernel of the concept. I laid it out in an email, basically, to the other players so that they could get kind of cooking on it. And then we sat down, actually, as our first session and batted all these ideas around and really fleshed it out and made it something that we all had contributed to, so that even though each of the players had a constraint, they had to start at the outpost, they had to know the mentor, they had to have worked at the outpost, they had to no longer be at the outpost, they had to currently be on a particular raft called the Blackwater Cat that was heading down the river toward the Lost Village. They had to want to get off the raft for some reason. I gave all those constraints and it really started making them think about, okay, so this character has got some history, he actually does something. It's not just a set of statistics.
And Tim also made three main requirements: that all of the characters had to start off at first level, that they had to have uncertain parentage, which threw kind of a monkey wrench into a couple of our plans, because we had kind of come up with a background already. And then the third requirement was no real home to speak of, which sometimes can be difficult because, well, these characters can really never go home.
You know, again, I put those particular constraints on from a really a mechanical perspective. And as we get on with the story of Northmoor, you'll see why the uncertain parentage and no home to speak of is critical to the game.
One of Tim's highlights that he usually puts into a game is the idea of secrets. We have secrets amongst one another. We have secrets that the group knows that other people from outside the group won't know. We have secrets that one person in the group would know about you. You have personal secrets that nobody else knows about at all.
And for most of the characters, it really wasn't that complicated to kind of come up with some secrets about themselves and who might know about them and so forth. And one of the beautiful things about secrets is it forces you to actually have something in your background or something in your personality that is secret. And if it's something secret, then you have to have had a background and personality. And I think it really is a way of driving that background and personality out.
Well, and sometimes this can be a little bit difficult to communicate as well, especially when it's a secret one other person in your group knows, because you need to be very careful about that kind of communication.
Sure. And I'm not sure that I would do the secret one other person in your group knows again. I'm definitely going to make that optional when I post it, because I found that that didn't last very long.
Well, for some characters it did, but other characters it didn't. The other thing is I know in my particular case, I have some secrets regarding my character class and really where my power comes from. And we have to discuss that out of character at the table. And sometimes that oozes back into the character. And so it's a little bit difficult. And I think that maybe writing notes might help that go along a little bit better.
The point of the secrets is twofold. One is to really help you flesh out the background and personality of your character and just to make you think about it from an oblique angle. And the second is to have those secrets come out and play and be a really cool role-playing moment.
One of the interesting things that we did do, though, was Tim was unable to attend part of our group session when we were deciding on the group template. And so he kind of disappeared because he had a software release that night.
Yeah, again, back to the whole real world gaming thing.
And so the rest of us sat down and we took notes. Tim really didn't get to hear a lot of what we were talking about, and he only had the notes to go off of.
Right, which actually was kind of cool because I got to not be there to influence you guys so much. So I think that there was some stuff that came out, you know, that I might have said something about that steered you in a different direction.
And I agree. I think that was, for the most part, a positive influence. Mind you, one of the problems with that was we need to be very careful about how we set timelines up.
Ah, right. So a lot of this is when you're starting to build a background, especially for an Eladrin character that goes back a long time. We had a little bit of crisscrossing of, you know, when the mentor was in a certain place and when they knew him and all that.
So when you're working with this group template, and if your GM isn't present, take the time to write down a timeline, especially if you have some longer lived characters.
Yeah.
Because that will facilitate their planning when secrets do end up coming out.
You know, and a lot of people don't like to do so much background because it never comes out in play. Well, my goal with a background is to make a background that absolutely comes into play and right away. This isn't a background that might, oh, well, about like sixth level, someone from your background is going to show up. No, it's like from session one, the fact that you were a former pirate or you were a former spy or whatever else should come into the game right away and definitely impact it immediately. Having this sort of background stretching backwards into time also means that you have things to talk about in a role-playing perspective. One of the hardest things when you sit down with a fresh set of characters is having anything to talk about in character. But if you can say, hey, remember back when we were at the outpost and there was that one big battle and you know, I stubbed my toe really bad, and oh yeah, and then you can make up stories about that.
Well, and that's one of the nice things also of having NPCs that are in common, because we could tell stories of our mentor, and we can go, oh, really? I didn't know about that. So it gives the players an opportunity to also be storytellers.
Right. And we often use this whole improv concept of say yes. I mean, if Kim says, oh, yeah, you know, the mentor and I were lovers for, you know, many years back before you knew him, I'm not going to say no to that. I mean, unless there's something that I absolutely know is coming up in the story that would make that untrue, why would I say no to that? Just roll with it. And the rest of the characters would be like, well, that explains some stuff. Or,
and that way they can add parts of their relationship with the mentor saying, oh, well, I really never realized, or, well, that's why I was never able to be as close with the mentor, or whatever it would be.
We went through all that with all the characters, you know, what their relationship was and what the relationship was to each other, and wrote all that down and, you know, just kind of sketched it out during the course of a session. And one of the things that we found is that even though I had sent the email out ahead of time and most of the people had done some thinking about their character, people didn't have time to really, you know, dive into it in detail. So we had to spend a whole gaming session really going through that. And your group might be different. You might be able to handle all that in an email discussion or whatever else. But we really found that it's much cooler and more dynamic if you sit down and do it together physically.
Especially the group stuff. For instance, two of our members of the group are in a car a lot. That's their job. And so they don't have the opportunity to sit down at a computer and really type everything out. They might have it in their brain. They might have an idea of what they want to do, but they haven't had the opportunity to sit down. And as Jeff said, look, man, this is going to be gaming day is Wednesdays, and that's when I'm going to do gaming. And that's exactly right, because he's got a life, he's got family, and that should not have anything to do with his enjoyment of gaming, but his gaming shouldn't influence those other parts of his life.
You just have to take the time to say, you know, making up a cool set of characters and integrating them into the world and taking who these characters are and changing the world based on who the characters are is just as important as sitting down to play 30 levels of D&D. Taking that one or two sessions to do that really does pay off in the end.
Because this is your foundation. And if you have a weak foundation, your whole game is going to be tottering back and forth on really not a good idea.
When all was said and done, we had some stuff that got hashed out. We came up with a name for the mentor. We came up with their relationship to him. They decided that he was sort of their captain. And interestingly enough, as everything got said and hashed, it turned out that Kim's character, Dan's character, and Jeff's character all had information gatherer spy type roles, even though one was a cleric, one was a rogue, and one was a warlock. They all came up with cool ideas of why and how that all integrated into something else, whereas Wick's character, who was a fighter, really didn't have that at all. In fact, he was a pretty straightforward fighter, so they came up with this hilarious idea that whenever the mentor, who they named Kontos, was off doing the spy stuff with one or all of them, that he would leave Wick's character, Rogan, in charge of the actual garrison at the outpost that he was in charge of. You know, he was completely clueless that all the spy stuff was going on. He thought that he was just off on a fling or off drilling the troops somewhere else or carrying supplies or on vacation or derelict of duty or whatever. So there's this really kind of amusing dichotomy between the players, whereas Rogan is this sort of straightforward fighter who's sort of clueless about all of this illicit activity that's going on information gathering and brokering.
Well, and part of it is that Tim has taken the time to set up some secret societies and things like that that one or more of the characters knows about. And so, you know, when you have a city or a town that has a great deal of wealth around it, you're going to have pirates. You're going to have people who want to get their hands on the wealth. And then with myself bringing this whole Eladrin city in, they may or may not be interested in what the humans are doing.
Again, my goal was to detail the absolute minimum amount that I could and then flesh that out with the assistance of the players sitting down, but still keep it focused on that tight area, the Northmoor area around the bog, the Lost Village, and the outpost, so that we didn't spend a whole lot of time detailing stuff that wouldn't come up, and so that the future could be wide open. We could say, you know what, we really need to have a big city to the south where maybe some evil merchants are from or something like that. And when that comes up, we'll sit down and we'll make it happen. And I might have some stuff that I need to have in there for the story purposes, and I might keep that close to the chest, and I might let everything else about it be defined by the player.
And that typically works really well. Don't waste your time on things that you don't need to waste your time on.
Yeah, don't waste your time on 22 pages of background from birth to loss of virginity or whatever you want to cover, unless that's going to come up later in the game, or unless you think it might come up later in the game.
as players, when you're making your characters, have some hooks in there for your GM, because it's hard to come up with really great stories and really great NPCs if your characters are flat. If there's nothing for them to be excited about or concerned about or worried about, then the GM doesn't have anything to work with.
Yeah, if you have nothing to care about, it's awfully hard to lure you into a story. And that's why I went to this great trouble to make these constraints of you had to work at the outpost, you had to have a relationship with this mentor and everything else. You know, I think everybody saw that this is probably going to be part of the adventure hook going in, and that's one of the reasons that I wrote it that way, is so that there was a built-in adventure hook, because nothing annoys me more than having to sit down and say, okay, there's five guys in a tavern, you're going to go? Nah, I don't really feel like going. All right, fine, I guess I have to, you know, bind you and throw you naked in a dungeon, as one of our friends would always do with his game.
Yeah, and, you know, and that's no fun to play. Other thing that we did during the character creation was to figure out our roles within the group. You know, we do have a fighter, but there can be fighters that aren't just front men. We can have fighters that they want to assist from the back. We have a rogue. That doesn't necessarily mean that he's the super sneaky kind of guy. He might be a merchant.
So part of it is that we had to sit down and say, okay, well, this group has worked together for a while, so they're going to have that sort of stuff worked out. What roles do we want to have them have sort of in an action situation? And we came up with, here's how it's going to go. But of course, all of that morphs and changes once the dice come out.
Because my original idea for this character was, because she's an Eladrin, because she's with the Fae, she would be somewhat of a person who understood secrets and really knew a lot of people in the town and in the surrounding areas because of her somewhat foreignness, and that people were somewhat fascinated with her. But then once I found out that Dan's character, Oshkin, was going to be a dwarven thief and somewhat of a spy master, well, that kind of idea went out the window.
So we're really hoping that when someone else sits down with their group to do the same sort of thing, and they have sort of the same constraints around the outpost and all that, to see what kind of cool characters they come up with and how the world changes. Because the world isn't fixed. You've heard us describe how it developed for us, but really only that core of the outpost, the bog, and the lost village is fixed. Everything else really is up to all of you to develop.
So once you get some ideas and your characters are getting made, your groups are getting put together, we'd love to hear from you on our forums, which, again, are at
SpookyOuthouse.com.
If you can just let us know what's going on, we'd love to hear your ideas.
Right. So you've gotten the basics of characters and how to create them and the world. Next time, we're actually going to talk about the very first adventure. We'll look forward to hearing your feedback.
All right. So until next time, we'll talk to you later.
Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Return to Northmoor, a podcast released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 2.5 license by Tim White and Kim Stone.
Our theme music is Charge of the Valiant from Dronolin's Tower, Legends of Kithelin Volume 1, Tales of the Long Forgotten, used by permission of its composer, David Alan Young. Find out more about their fantastic gaming music at dronolin.com. Visit us and many other fine podcasts at SpookyOuthouse.com.